Okay, so yesterday I had talked a bit about root systems, and I'm going to continue to say a little bit about root systems and then get into looking at parabolic subgroups. So let's say we had a root system, capital C. We say it is irreducible if it cannot be expressed as the union of two mutually orthogonal subsets. So we have our log group invariant inner product on the vector space in which the root system sits, and that gives us a notion of orthogonality. Pardon me? Sure. Okay, so now, in general, phi will not be irreducible. And in that case, you can partition it in a unique way. Partitioned into uniquely. Into a union of irreducible root systems. In subspaces of this. So this, the other root systems are, the irreducible root systems are in proper subspaces. And what you can think about is the example of a direct product. If you have a reductive group that is a direct product of two reductive groups, and you look at the root system of that group, then you can partition it in a natural way, corresponding to the individual factors in that direct product, into a union of two mutually orthogonal proper subsets, which may or not be irreducible depending on whether or not the root systems of the factors are irreducible. Okay, and you can, I'm not going to discuss this here, actually get some information from this. You can partition phi into a union like this and then start asking, well, how close can we get G, how can we get information from G related, can we define subgroups in terms of those root systems, and how close is G to being the direct product of those groups having those root systems. But I'm actually not going to talk about that, how that is done. And we would say that group G is simple, or almost simple. Actually, I think almost simple is the more standard terminology here. If G contains no proper non-trivial closed connected normal subgroup, I think some people reserve simple for just saying there's no closed normal subgroup at all. But in any case, if this is the case, if G is semi-simple and connected, though in my definition of semi-simple I assume connected, then the group will be simple if and only if its root system that irritable. Okay. So this tells you something about the properties of irreducible resistance. Okay, and before continuing, I will say I did define semisimple and reductive for connected groups only. Almost all of the basic theorems are proved for connected, reductive, and semisimple groups, but if you want, and if you're reading the literature, and if you see the terminology reductive group, and you're not assuming the group is connected, then they're just assuming that the identity component of the group is reductive. And the same thing with semisimple. Okay, now, you only have certain irreducible root systems. So a root system is reduced if, as I mentioned last time, if you have a root in the root system, no positive integral multiple of that root can also belong to the root system. So the reduced irreducible root systems are those of type an, n greater than or equal to 1, bn, n greater than or equal to 1, cn, n greater than or equal to 3, dn, n greater than or equal to 4, e6, e7, e8, E7, E8, F4, and G2. Now here, in this talk, I'm not describing what all these root systems are, but in any of the standard references, you can look at a description of what these root systems are. A couple of them will come up in examples. And then there's also some non-reduced irreducible root systems, and there's one for each N. There is one non-reduced irreducible system called BCN. Okay, now if n is greater than or equal to 2, one example we looked at was GLN, the root system of GLN, as we will see shortly, is of type an minus 1. Okay, n here is actually the n here is indicating the rank of the system. And let's see, how about the other example we looked at? SP. P2n, here, take n greater than or equal to 1. The root system is of type Cn. Oh, but I only want n greater than or equal to 3. Okay, but there is a C2, but C2 is the same as B2. And C1 is A1. So A1, N equals 1, B2, N equals 2. And you can call that C2 if you want, you can call that C1 if you want. Okay, so for small n, there's some coincidence between root systems. But if we want to say the different ones, then that's why I've taken n greater than or equal to 3 here. Okay, and we'll look at that in an example as well. Okay, so let's look at what we call root datum. So let's take in parentheses connected reductive linear algebraic group and T maximal torus. Here we'll use these to produce roots and co-roots and so on. So let's look at the following quadruple. Call it psi of G and T. Take the characters of T and the one parameter subgroups. So here we have our homomorphisms to GM. Here we have our homomorphism GM to T. Take the roots of G relative to T, and then take the coroots. So the fourth thing, I don't quite have room to write it over there, is the set of coroots. So attached to each root, there is a coroot in here, as I defined last time. So look at those, that quadruple made up of those four sets. Okay. And often I'll just write that as x, y, t, and t check, dropping the g and t from the notation. That quadruple is what we call a root datum. So root systems, we often use root systems to classify semi-simple Lie algebras. To some extent, the semi-simple groups as well. And what we use to classify the reductive groups are the root data. Okay, so what's a root datum? Well, we have a notion, just as with root system, we produce these roots, and we said they're a root system, and there's an abstract notion of root system and some axioms that a root system has to satisfy. You also have that with a root datum. So And a lot of the properties are related to properties of root systems, not surprisingly, since look what's occurring here in the quadruple. Okay, so an abstract root datum. Luckily, it doesn't take too long to write down the axioms here. Is a quadruple x, y, z. Well, now I'm just referring to the x, y, and the c check, so I'm not talking about a reductive group or a torus, but what properties do x and y have? Well, let's see, x and y are free abelian groups. And there's a bilinear mapping. X plus y to integers, inducing isomorphisms. X should be isomorphic to homomorphisms from Y to Z. Y X to the integers. Phi should be inside X. Phi check should be inside Y. This should be finite. Both of them. And there exists a bijection of phi onto phi check. Alpha goes to alpha check, phi onto phi check. And such that the following two axioms are satisfied. Look at what happens when we pair alpha and alpha check. We should get two. And the second axiom for root datum, define S alpha going from x to x and S alpha check going from y to y by S alpha say just x equals x minus pair x with alpha check times alpha. S alpha check y, y minus alpha y. This is for x and x, y and y. Okay, so I'm just defining those, and I have to tell you the axiom. It just tells you that I have to take, okay, this is for each alpha and each alpha check, you have one of these, and you are required that each time you do this, you apply it to phi, you've got to take it back into phi, and S alpha check would have to take phi check back into phi check. Okay. Well, alpha. So you can see that a lot of the things that are happening with our root systems are encoded here. And if you think about I'm using even the same notation, right? The S alpha is going to correspond when I have a root datum that's coming from the reductive group and a maximal torus, it's going to correspond to the reflection relative to the root alpha. Okay. So anyway, you have these two axioms that have to be satisfied. And in general, if you just take an abstract root datum, and if phi is actually non-empty, I did not require phi to be non-empty here, but if phi is non-empty, then it will be a root system. If you just look at, if phi happens to be non-empty, if phi is a root system in the vector space, take the subgroup of x generated by phi tensor over the integers with the reals. Okay, so you can recover a root system from a root datum, and similarly, phi check will be a root system as well. Okay, and phi check will be the dual of the root system phi, not only just some root system. So phi check is the dual. Let's see. So it's set up to encode the information that you get in that particular setting. Okay, so you can also define a dual root datum just by interchanging x and y and phi and phi check. Okay, so I'll mention that here. It's psi check, which check C is also a root datum. Let me call it the dual. Okay, and we have a third axiom which we might or might not be satisfied, and it's just related to the root systems. The root datum is reduced if the root system phi is reduced. Okay, so psi is reduced. Yeah, phi is reduced as a root system. Basically, alpha in phi means then that twice alpha is not in phi. Okay, in this particular case, we get a reduced root datum. So psi gt is reduced. Well, we know that already because we know that root system is reduced. Okay. There's a notion of isomorphism of root data. If you have two root data, an x and a y, a phi and a phi check, and then an x prime and a y prime and a phi prime and a phi prime check, you would want something that, I won't write this down, I'll just mention it, you should have a group isomorphism from x to x primed. It should induce a bijection of phi to phi primed. And it's the dual map should induce a bijection of phi prime check onto phi check. That kind of thing. Okay, so we have a notion of isomorphism of of root data. Okay. Okay, so now suppose I just took a reduced root datum. For some reason I produced one. And there's a theorem that tells us that that reduced root datum is a root datum of coming from a connected reductive group. Psi is a reduced root datum there exists a reductive group G such that psi is a quadruple obtained from G and T. If you replace T by any other maximal torus, you're replacing T by a torus which is conjugate to T, and it's easy to see that the effect on the root datum is to give you an isomorphic root datum. So the T isn't really that important. But also, I mean, more importantly, that you could also have more general isomorphisms as well. And so I'll just say that G is unique up to isomorphism, sort of waving my hands about the choice of T, because I know that changing T gives me an isomorphism anyway. Isomorphism. Okay, now this is assuming I fixed my field K. If you look at the definition of abstract root datum, the field K does not appear anywhere. So this construction will give you a connected reductive group for each algebraically closed field. Okay, so maybe I should say K group there. And then there's a K group that's unique up to isomorphism. But if I change to a different field, of course, I get another group that has no relation to the original one, except that it has the same root datum. Okay, so you can use root data to actually classify or parameterize all of the connected reductive groups over your given algebraically closed field. Okay, you can also, when you're, if you're looking at L groups, this data comes into the L groups in the sense that you may start with a group over some field that, and then you may look at an L group which is a semi-direct product of a connected reductive complex algebraic group and some other thing like a Ray group or a Galois group. And the way you produce that L group is to do with the root data, because you can just take a root system or root datum and produce an algebraic connected reductive group over whatever field you want. Okay, so it comes into that, although I'm not really talking about L groups at all here. Okay, so now, so roots come up in this kind of thing, and they also come up in classifying what we call parabolic subgroups. So I want to talk about parabolic subgroups now. But actually, before I do that, why don't I put up some transparencies about root systems and examples. Okay. Oh, now what do I have to do to focus that? that's close. I think. That's readable anyway. Can people see that? Yeah. Okay, so this is a very elementary example. Just take the general linear group with n at least 2. Take the natural maximal torus consisting of diagonal matrices in the group, and your character group of T is isomorphic to Zn, and I'm just choosing an EI with a, you know, the standard thing with a 1 in the i-th position and 0s elsewhere, and identifying that n-tuple of the ki's with the character that takes the diagonal matrix with entries T1 to Tn to the element T1 to the K1 times T2 to the K2, etc. Okay, and then of course your one-parameter subgroups can also be identified in the same way. You're taking something in K cross and you're just getting something in the torus, and this is just a blob. That's not there really. You're just taking the relevant powers of T in the entries of the matrix. So T to the K1, and then T to the K2, and then so on. Okay, and the natural pairing we know is composition of the map. So obviously if you compose, you take T to this, there's L's now, putting L's there, and then you apply the character with the KIs to that, and you just get the integer KILI. The map that you get by composing takes an element T of K cross to T to the K, this power here. Okay, so that's what the pairing would be. Now if you look at the roots, well, you're just looking at the conjugation action of T on the Lie algebra. The Lie algebra is just n by n matrices, so you can see what the eigenspaces are very easily when you conjugate by a diagonal matrix. What does it do to the entries of the matrix? Okay, so what you're getting here is chi, I'm writing it EI minus EJ, so you're looking there at something on the IJth entry of a matrix. This is telling you, EI, take a matrix EIJ, which has a 1 in the IJth entry and zeros elsewhere. And then look at that character there, then the root space is just spanned by EIJ. When you conjugate, you get the obvious effect. And the U alpha, which is supposed to have Lie algebra equal to the root space G alpha, is then in this case really easy to figure out. It's just the identity plus scalar multiples of EIJ. Okay, and then if you look at the reflection S alpha, what's it going to do? It's going to take alpha to minus alpha, which means it's going to permute EI and EJ. And it's going to leave all the other EK's fixed. Well, if you can think about that, you can see that if you look at those various reflections, you're just permuting n-tuples. You're permuting EI. So you get what you generate when you do that. You get the symmetric group on n letters. You could also see the vowel group directly. Look at the normalizer of the torus, and you see that it permutes the entries of the torus, and there are n entries, possible entries in the diagonal matrix. And so again, you get Sn. I mean, you can always find a matrix in GLN that's going to permute the I and the J's entry of the torus. Just take the relevant permutation matrix. Okay, and then our co-roots are looking as elements of Zn, the same as the roots, although we think of them as elements of Y. And one choice for a base is just the characters EI minus EI plus 1, corresponding to EI minus EI plus 1. And I can't talk about Borel subgroups yet, so ignore the rest of that. I'll come back to that. Okay. Now, what about FC4? Okay, so take a 4x4 symplectic group. I'm not going to write out the n by n example, 2n by 2n example. Then we have, I'm just reminding you of first of the definition of the group and then what the Lie algebra is. If you take the diagonal entries in the group, it is a maximal torus. Of course, you can't just take a diagonal entry matrix in GL4. It has to actually be in the symplectic group, and that's why we have this condition on the matrix entries. AB B inverse A inverse for the diagonal matrix. And then you can parameterize your characters in terms of the relevant powers to which A and B are raised. And you can do the same thing. This is a bit messy here, but I'm just mapping T to that diagonal matrix there. And one of this should be a minus I, not a minus J. So minus I. And then the pairing is as before. When you compose, you can see that you end up raising T to this power if you compose the characters, this one parameter subgroup with this character. Okay. And then I'm just naming some of these characters. I'm calling the one corresponding to 1 minus 1 the chi 1 minus 1 and 0, 2, because I'm identifying the root. So I would look at how does a matrix like this act by conjugation on these matrices in the Lie algebra, and I would look for the eigenspaces, the non-zero eigenspaces. And what I would get is, given that this choice of alpha and beta, I would get eigenspaces for alpha and minus alpha, beta and minus beta, and plus or minus alpha plus beta, plus or minus 2 alpha plus beta. If you look at, and it's quite easy to check. I mean, they're just 4 by 4 matrices, and you look what happens when you conjugate by the relevant diagonal matrix. Okay? And then what, I'll just tell you what roughly, a little more about the root spaces. So for the alpha that I defined, not just an arbitrary alpha, but the alpha I defined, then the G alpha is the span of E12 minus E34. So you've got a matrix, a block, 0, 1, 0, 0, and then 0 there, and then 4 zeros here, and then 0 minus 1, 0, 0 there. Okay? And for minus alpha, in fact, you just take the transpose of the element that spans G alpha, and you get the space for minus alpha. And then for G beta, you're getting just the span of E23, so with a non-zero entry in the 2-3 position. And you can work out the other ones as well. For alpha plus beta, you have to have something that looks like a multiple of the identity in the block in the corner, 2-by-2 block in the corner. And for 2 alpha plus beta, you just have one entry that's non-zero. And if the set alpha beta is a base, and obviously we know bases are not unique, but that is a base, well, you can just see from the way I described the roots that it is a base. If you look at the set of roots, can you write every root as in terms of alpha and beta with either all the coefficients non-negative or non-positive? It's clear, because you only have plus or minus alpha, plus or minus beta, plus or minus alpha plus beta, and plus or minus 2 alpha plus beta. So obviously that's a base. And then you can try to figure out what the reflections are corresponding to these simple roots. And, well, you know you have to take alpha to minus alpha. And all I've done also is indicated the hyperplanes that are actually where the thing acts as the identity. Okay? How do you know that it does this? Well, you can just figure it out by saying it's got to fix the roots, because S alpha is completely determined by the fact that it takes alpha to minus alpha and it takes theta phi. There's only going to be one linear transformation that does that and fixes a one-dimensional subspace and takes alpha to minus alpha. And if you want to look at the corresponding element of the Weyl group, well, you just say, what does the reflection do? And you can see that you could take a representative for that element of the Weyl group as this matrix. And you could do the same thing with the simple reflection S beta. Then you take beta to minus beta. This is the hyperplane fixed by it. And the element of the normalizer, or corresponding element of the Weyl group should be the mod T. Just put mod T there. It's represented by this. So it's just permuting the two. When it conjugates, just permutes these two. And this one actually switches both the A and the B and the A inverse and the B inverse. Okay? Now, you could write down the reflections for the other elements of the Weyl group, but you don't have to, because the Weyl group is actually generated by the reflections corresponding to a basis. So I can tell what the Weyl group is. Okay. You can figure out that those two matrices generate a dihedral group of order 8. Okay. Now the co-roots in this case are not the same. They don't look the same as the roots when you identify the x and the y. Okay. So I have written them down here. The alpha check does look like alpha, but the beta check does not look like beta. Okay, it looks like beta over 2. And the alpha plus beta check is different than 2 alpha plus beta also. It's of type C2, which is also B2, and phi check is of type B2, but it's also C2. In this case, your phi and your phi check are the same because the rank is so small that B2 is equal to C2. In general, I could do the same thing for SP2N. Could have a bigger basis, but I would get a root system of type CN, and the dual would be of type BN, and if N is bigger than 2, BN and CN are actually not isomorphic root systems. So you actually change types when you go from phi to phi check. Okay, but this should, of course I haven't written down any details, but it's just 4x4 matrices. I mean, really, it's not difficult to do. In a lot of examples, you can, okay, I've chosen some classical groups, but in classical groups, it's really easy to say what root systems look like. And if you're sort of phased by all these abstract definitions of root systems and axioms, the axioms are just there because they reflect what actually happens in examples. You can get a good intuition about root systems if you look at enough examples in of root systems that actually occur for reductive groups. Okay. So, back to the more examples later. Okay, so now I want to discuss parabolic subgroups. And first of all, you generally look at what we call Borel subgroups. So for now, just for a moment, let's just take G to be a connected linear algebraic group, and let's not assume that it's reductive. We will very soon. So connected linear algebraic group. Okay, so look at the set of connected closed, solvable subgroups of G. So you want a connected closed subgroup of G, which happens to be a solvable group. Okay. Ordered by inclusion. Contains maximal elements. Such a maximal element is called a Borel subgroup. A maximal element is called a Borel subgroup. And there are some general facts about Borel subgroups, which are simply stated. So let's let B be a Borel subgroup. Then, in that case, if we look at, of course, it's not normal, but it's, look at the coset space. This is actually a projective variety. In general, these coset spaces are quasi-projective varieties. When we take a Borel subgroup, it's a projective variety. And furthermore, if you now consider, and also I can say, and any other Borel subgroup is conjugate to B. So these maximal elements are not actually unique, but they are up to conjugacy. Okay, any two maximal elements are conjugate. So now, in general, you can look at a closed subgroup of G and ask when is the coset space going to be projective variety? And it's going to be exactly when you actually contain a Borel subgroup. And only if P contains a Borel subgroup. So it contains some conjugate of the B. So if I wanted to parameterize all of the parabolic, what we call these parabolic subgroups, such a P is called a parabolic subgroup. If you want to parameterize the parabolic subgroups, then you can just say, okay, well, take a B and let's figure out what the parabolics that contain that B are, and then all the others are just conjugate to those. Okay. Such a P will be connected. It will be equal to its normalizer. So the normalizer of G and P will equal P. And also, if you have two parabolics and they both contain a fixed Borel, they cannot be conjugate unless they actually coincide. Okay. So if P and P prime are parabolic subgroups containing my given B, then what can we say? Then P is conjugate to be primed, if and only if they're actually equal. Okay, so that tells you a little more about how you would try to parameterize the parabolic. You know that the up to conjugacy, you're going to get just the things that can contain B, and not only that, if two of them contain B, they're not going to be conjugate unless they're equal. Okay, so now assume that G is reductive. Okay, now take a maximal torus. It turns out that in the reductive case, we can describe the parabolic subgroups very nicely in terms of tori and roots and the root groups, that is the U alphas that are attached to the roots. So I take them. So in order to do that, we should take a maximal torus. Okay. Then T must lie in some Borel subgroup. So take fix such a B. B is not unique, so you have to pick one. And now let's look at the unipotent radical. So I'm going to call it U. R sub U of B. So this is a unipotent radical. You look at the radical of B and then you look at the subgroup consisting of unipotent elements. So this is a subgroup of B consisting of unipotent elements. Okay, so then how do you relate this to roots? Well, actually it's through U, because U is actually going to be generated by certain root groups. I think that maybe... Then there exists a unique base delta of the root system such that U is generated by the root groups corresponding to the positive roots. So U is generated by the U alpha, alpha range over the positive roots. Okay, so attached to each alpha, we have this nice connected unipotent p-stable subgroup whose Lie algebra is that eigenspace G alpha, and well, we get one for each root. And then now, after we choose a base, we look at P plus, which is just the roots, where when I express them in terms of linear combinations of the simple roots in the base, all the coefficients that you get have to be non-negative. And I take those subgroups, and I look at the group generated by them, and I get exactly the unipotent radical of the Borel. So what's happening is that you actually have a bijection between the bases of the root system and Borel subgroups containing that given maximal torus. And this is how this arises. To produce the Borel subgroup corresponding to a basis, you take the group generated by the U alpha for the positive roots. Okay. So I'll just write that down. The set of Borel subgroups of G containing T via this map here is one-to-one correspondence with the basis, set of bases of. Okay, and the vowel group permutes a set of bases simply transitively and analogously permutes the set of Borel subgroups. You start conjugating these Borel subgroups containing T by elements of the vowel group. Well, you're going to get a subgroup that's a Borel subgroup because it's conjugate to the original one. You conjugate it by an element of the vowel group, so that's certainly going to take T to T, so you're going to get a Borel subgroup containing T back. Okay, and the way that the vowel group permutes the bases actually corresponds to the way that the vowel group permutes the Borel subgroups, and that is fairly obvious since we produce the unipotent radical of the Borel subgroup from the positive. So the vowel group W therefore permutes of Borel subgroups containing T simply transitively. Okay, and you can also say that the set of Borel subgroups containing T will generate. Okay. Now, I noticed that you already know something about Borel subgroups and parabolic subgroups in DLN because Jim Arthur saw his notes on the board before I started and he wrote down the parabolic subgroups of GLN. And I'll mention those again here. And then also look at another example. Before I talk about how you get the general parabolic subgroups, I want to talk about the Bruhat decomposition. Let B be a Borel subgroup of G. And let C be a maximal torus of G contained in B. Then I can say that G is actually the disjoint union of the BB double cosets, and the representative for those double cosets are just elements of the Borel group. So it's the disjoint union of the double cosets BWB as W ranges over a set of representatives of W in the normalizer. And we often don't even say set of representatives. We just say W ranges over the Borel group, and we assume that you know we're only taking a set of representatives. Okay, so anything in G is in one of these double cosets, and these two of these double cosets coincide exactly when the element of you get the same element of the Borel group. Okay. All right. So you get it. Quite nice decomposition of a group relative to B. Now, I want to describe parabolic subgroups, not just Borel subgroups. The Borel subgroups, I can just say, well, I can get them from each choice of positive roots, at least as far as the ones that are containing P are concerned. So now, how would I get a parabolic subgroup? Well, up to conjugacy, it contains my given Borel. So all I really need to do is describe the parabolic subgroups that contain my given Borel subgroup. So let's take a base. So let's say we have a B and a T there of P Z base corresponding to B. Okay, now, if I is a subset, so what's going to happen is I'm going to get a parabolic subgroup for each subset of this base. So, take a subset. Well, let Wi be the subgroup of W generated by the set of simple reflections, the reflections corresponding to simple roots alpha, as alpha ranges through I. So the Borel group is generated by the S alphas as alpha ranges through all of the whole base. So now I'm saying, let's just take a subset of that generating set, the S alphas where alpha is in I, and look at the subgroup generated by that subset. Okay, I'm going to use this to produce a parabolic subgroup. Well, one way to do that is the following. I know that from the Bruja decomposition, that I've got G as a union of these B double cosets. So I could describe a subgroup containing B in terms of which double cosets it contains. So I'm going to let Pi be the union of the various double cosets like this. Okay? Now, when I write Wi, I mean you choose an element in the normalizer of T that represents the element of the vowel group, and you take that double coset, as I did above. Okay? If you had just chosen the empty set, which is allowed, you would have just got B. So B corresponds to the empty set. Notice P. Empty set is just B itself, because then W is 1, and then P of all delta is, well, I'm allowing everything there, and I'm just going to get back G. And then as I, if I happen to have any other subsets of I, I'm going to get some parabolic groups other than B and G. Okay, so Pi is a parabolic subgroup. Of G. And any subgroup, not just any subgroup of G containing B, containing B, or a subgroup containing B equals Pi for some I. So I can actually describe the parabolic subgroup containing B in terms of subgroups of the vowel group generated by subsets of the base that corresponds to the Borel, and any other parabolic would be conjugate to this. Now, I can also describe this in a nice way in terms of generators and relations, and it's going to have a semi-direct product decomposition in terms of some very nice reductive subgroup and its unipotent radical. If you look at the Borel subgroup that you start with, in fact, the B is actually a semi-direct product of the torus that you started with and the unipotent radical U. I did call it U, I think. And for parabolics, well, P is a torus, so it's reductive, but it's not a very interesting reductive group. And in general, your parabolics are looking like not tori, but centralizers of tori. They're centralizers of subtori of T. And then you can say, okay, I've got a reductive group, it's a centralizer of this torus. What are the roots of T in this reductive group? And you can describe it explicitly, and you get explicit generators. And then you can also say, well, what is the unipotent radical? The subgroup of U, it'll be generated by certain root groups. You just have to say which positive roots you should take. Because you shouldn't take all of them, because you'll get too big, you'll get the unipotent radical of V. So I can write that out quite easily. And I will do that next time, just describing in terms of roots what these parabolic subroots look like. And I'll do examples and so on. And also, what I haven't done yet is I have not considered at all what happens when you work over k-rational points. So I'm also going to talk about how you parameterize parabolic subroots over k-rational points, because it's slightly different. Things don't split, so you don't necessarily even have a Borel subgroup that's defined over the k-rational points if you take a subfield. So for this material, the absolute theory, which is the theory over the algebraically closed field, this kind of parameterization that I've started to talk about now and will continue with tomorrow is in the standard references, the three books that I mentioned at the beginning. And some of the relative theory also is, and maybe I'll mention some more references for that tomorrow. I'll also be looking at some examples of where I explicitly write down what standard parabolic subgroups in various reductive groups are.